This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Kane Smigo heard his first hip-hop song when he was in kindergarten. And by second grade, he was freestyling at the bus stop and the lunch table, and then years later made it to national and international poetry slams. And at the core of his work is The Cypher, a circle in which people rap and beatbox in a collective. It's a space that lays the foundation for the creation of community and music. In his new one-man show, Kane traces his life story through many ciphers that have shaped his identity. Along the way, he interrogates race, the American South, and the power of language. The show is called Temples of Lung and Air. It's directed by Joseph Meagle. It's on stage in Chapel Hill next week, presented by Playmakers Repertory Company and Street Sign Center for Literature and Performance. Kane Smigo joins us in the studio. Welcome back. It's been a long time.
It's been too long. Yeah, how you doing, Frank?
I am doing well, and apparently you are too.
Yes, sir.
Many of our listeners will know you best as a slam poet. You co-founded the youth poetry nonprofit Sacrificial Poets, and since then you've been touring and performing all over the world. Nice to see you back. What brings you back to North Carolina? Talk about the construction of this one-man show.
How'd that come about? Well, it feels really special to be back. You know, I've been in L.A. for the last 4 years, and I try to be as bi-coastal as I can. But to be able to premiere the piece back in the home state, where I think it will resonate, you know, especially, feels great. It's kind of a culmination of the past 10 years of experimenting with the art forms of poetry, of hip-hop verse, a little bit of drama and acting, storytelling, beatboxing, you know, trying to blur the lines of those mediums. And trying to, you know, really be vulnerable and go into my story and how
I fit in. It traces your life story through your evolving relationship with rap and hip-hop. Tell us a story when you were first exposed to the music in kindergarten.
Yeah, well, my brother made me a mixtape that had a bunch of different songs. Had, you know, Mama Said Knock You Out by LL Cool J. Had the Rubber Ducky song on there. You know, a bunch of different songs. So that was my first kind of hearing that and hearing Criss Cross. Do Jump Jump, and they were, you know, young teenage rappers. So as an elementary schooler, they were kind of the big kids, and I was like, I want to do that. And the rest is history. You know?
You spent most of your early life growing up in Durham as a young white kid in a diverse environment, both inside and outside of your house. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the kind of dynamics of Durham and the dynamics of my neighborhood and the school I went to were very diverse. I also grew up with my mom, who raised me, and my mom's partner, who's a black man from Durham, a professor of African-American history and political science, and then split time between there and my dad and my grandparents' house, which was up in West Virginia. And they're, you know, my grandparents are white folks originally from Middle America. So obviously some differing, often opposing narratives around race that caused a lot of confusion for me. And so the piece is kind of talking about that feeling of being juxtaposed between these two different narratives.
And you talk about perhaps the first time you felt this acutely when you brought your mother's partner, an African-American man, to class one day.
Yeah, because he was, you know, him being a historian and a scholar, he was invited in fourth grade when we learned about North Carolina history. You know, he was brought in to speak, and I just remember some of the reactions of the kids and being like, that's your dad? Or, and, you know, of course, the fact that they were partners, but they weren't married, and just all the dynamics being in the South and in North Carolina and trying to understand that. And all I remember is the confusion of just feeling like, why is this weird? And it kind of manifested in me, you know, being awkward and being, you know, quieter than I usually was.
What about that West Virginia experience? I mean, you suggested that that would have been not as diverse and perhaps not as open to diversity.
Definitely not as
diverse. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Well, when did you, how did you sense that? Because, again, kids just roll with that. Mm-hmm. That's the West Virginia family, and that's this family. When did it strike you as this is a real tension here?
Yeah, I mean, I think just some of the things, you know, my grandparents, one of the things I try to do in the show is really humanize all the characters that are in the show, because I loved my grandparents and they were great grandparents in many ways. My dad and I had a complicated relationship, but, you know, he was great in a lot of ways. But, you know, there were things that my grandparents said that are a lot of the stories that go untold from white communities, right? The stories that we keep behind closed doors. And so I would hear some of those things, whether it was political comments or comments about how folks who look like me should act or talk or how black people were, broad statements. And then, of course, I would go back after vacation home and get a different message from my mom. and from Burley and try to make sense of all that.
Well, I wonder if I can get you to do an excerpt from your show for us. Sure. Maybe you can set it up for us.
Sure. I mean, I think that's a perfect segue because this piece is talking about the history of one of the big elements in hip-hop is the DJ and the MC, what we call MC, now we call rapper, but is the master of ceremonies. And hip-hop is kind of the thread throughout the show, but I use it as a way to talk about the story of growing up between two households. So in hip-hop, two of the most important figures are the MC and the DJ. In the beginning, the DJ was actually star of the show. The master of ceremonies was just the hype man. With two turntables instead of one, and a crossfader, the DJ could switch between two records and keep loading in new ones so the music never stopped. And with good timing, the crossfader could move back and forth between the record on the left and the record on the right, blending them in different ways, like I've kind of grown up between songs, between left and right, between 13 stars on the flag look a lot like 13 Klansmen doing jumping jacks. Don't tell me it's the symbol of our pride in the South. Serbo. Some people try to say it's a symbol of Southern pride, Kane, but the truth is it was created to promote white supremacy by a government that fought to ensure that black people, blacks don't know how to talk right, Kane, and most of them are flunkies who don't care for their kids. They're not fathers. The man who was not my father teaches me to play chess. I teach my homeboy Sergio across the street, and my Sega Genesis collects dust for a couple months while our queens catfight on the stoop. I was a songbird caught between anthems, between left and right, or far left and far right.
That's writer and performer and hip-hop artist Kane Smigo performing an excerpt from his new one-man show, Temples of Lung and Air, on stage at the Elizabeth Price Keenan Theater in Chapel Hill next Wednesday, August 22nd through Sunday the 26th, presented by Playmakers and Street Signs. And, of course, you can find the information at our website, stateofthings.org. That's one piece, and it sort of capsulizes, as you told us, the story about being torn between these worlds, living in these worlds and navigating them. The production itself, how did that come together, and how do you assemble the pieces to make an entire show out of this?
Yeah, that's a question I've been trying to answer for the last 2 years, right?
Working
the process, yeah. Well, you know, I worked with director Joseph Meagle, who's also a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and his wife, Elizabeth Corley, who's the dramaturg in the show, helped me, you know, with editing and making sure all my commas were right and the narrative really felt full. So I started, as I moved out to L.A., he said, you know, if you ever write your one-man show, I'll direct it. And so that was the first seed, I think. And you know, I've always felt like between the 3-minute slam poem in competition and the 3 to 4 minute hip hop song, I wanted to examine what was possible outside of those kind of, you know, limits. And so I just started writing. That was the first thing. Started writing different segments and finding ways for them to fit together. And they've been really helpful in this process of making sure that the gaps are filled in.
You also use different voices in this. In that last piece, you were a kind of mediator. You were the observer of this kind of tension and could bring it to us using hip-hop as a form in an ingenious way, in a mediated way. But you also explore your own whiteness and what that means to have privilege in a world where you also didn't. You shared some of the subordinate status. Talk about that and using that exploration and talking in first person.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where the show goes inward and goes into the mirror, you know, because it's easy to talk about, or maybe not easy, but, you know, we can talk about things like race from a distance, right? Yeah. That's not me. Sometimes we talk about them in these like kind of abstract, you know, things. The ghost of the South is racist. That's not me. And so the show really also looks at that moment when you know, my mom's partner Burley came into my class and how I reacted. How did I internalize and how was I, socialized to internalize the rules of race? And, you know, sometimes the biggest manifestation of privilege is to not have to worry about seeing or noticing things. So I'm looking at that in the piece. What are the ways in which, you know, the way that I look affect the way that I'm received and the way that I show up? And even the way that I interact with an art form like hip hop that comes from the black community, you know, what are my responsibilities as kind of a guest in the house of hip hop, right, to make sure that I'm respecting the communities from which it came.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting questions in all this, because if you think about white supremacy and the lengths to which people go to defend it. I mean, we talked in our last segment about a white bus driver who kills an American soldier, yeah, because that soldier was about to violate the supreme law of the land. So being an American is second class, and of course it begins with the Confederacy. Yeah. Confederates killed American soldiers. Mm-hmm. There's a legacy of that, and you will kill American soldiers if it threatens the one and only prime directive, white supremacy. And that becomes, again, in the mouth and in the art of someone like you who's had to straddle those worlds, it seems to be a complicated story to have to tell.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, the show brings up the question of cultural appropriation, the idea of, you know, in white America, we consume other cultures very easily, but oftentimes remain disconnected from issues, or not committed, I guess, to issues that affect the people from which those cultures come. You know, the great example is, you know, I guess white rappers in the mainstream who, you know, kind of went silent during the, yeah, Black Lives Matter movement. You know, we like the art. It's really fun. Yeah. We want to use it to make money and have fun with it. But when it comes to being committed to the folks that created the art, folks get silent. So that's kind of the place that I'm kind of pushing and pulling in this piece.
Will you do another excerpt for us?
Sure. Yeah. It also deals with language, you know, because language is inextricably linked to, you know, to culture. When we talk about race, language definitely comes into play. So this next piece is kind of just about the way that we think about language. So I say, I ain't played in a while. You say, ain't? Really? How can you be a poet, someone who cares so much about words, and butcher the language with a word like ain't? Forgive mine, sneep hither. But peradventure thy historical distemperature hath led thee to englut yon motley marted and bavin troth, which I take in snuff, that the language thee and I speaketh anon hath been steeled still. That's early modern English from just about 400 years ago. Allow me to translate. Forgive my sarcasm here. But perhaps your historical laziness has led you to swallow that foolish and worthless idea, to which I take offense, that the language you and I speak now has been fixed and permanent forever. Well, it ain't. And it never will be. It took 3.5 billion years for life on Earth to evolve this invisible miracle. And you think you can stop the process? Think you can slay this hydra of 10,000 tongues, baby? This is ancient magic, to conjure image with sound. Lazarus, a memory, awaken the sweet mercy of laughter. You better stack your grammar books 10 stories high and let the match teach them its choir song of flame, because ain't no simple equation for this divine algebra of breath and throat, throat and tongue, tongue and ear. Ain't no way to chain up a miracle, especially not one with feet that walk on air. So where you gonna tie up the syllables? Padlock the diphthongs, bending bars, put all the idioms on trial. Tell the Creoles, pick a side, but only this one. It's the right one. Language won't meant to be pretty or proper or dressed in an undersized suit and told to sit still for the picture. So how was it meant to be spoken? It was meant to be spoken.
Writer and performer, hip-hop artist Kane Smigo. That's an excerpt from his new one-man show, Temples of Lung and Air, on stage at the Elizabeth Price Keenan Theater in Chapel Hill next Wednesday, the 22nd through the 26th, at our website, stateofthings.org, if you didn't get that. Ain't no simple equation. Talk about no simple equation. You had a profound experience when you were in Alaska a few years ago that really touches on this production and this kind of intersection.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a story that's in the show about, I don't want to give too much away, but I went kind of on a pilgrimage when I was up there. I had a couple gigs that took me up there, and then I found out that a friend of mine who was actually on the youth poetry team that I was on when I was first exposed to spoken word, her name was Ira Yarmolenko. She was killed in 2008, and, you know, it really rocked us to the core, that kind of close-knit group of friends. And I had known but had forgotten that she worked at a lodge up in Alaska for one summer. And when she passed, the workers were so moved by having known her that they built a bench with her name on it. And so when I found that out and I was up there, I was like, I got to go. And I was accompanied by a poet named Kima, who works with youth up there. And we went and saw the bench, and that was the beginning of this moment. But after that, we ended up having a moment, an experience with some locals in rural Alaska that made me at first very concerned, and but it gave me a window into the complexities of people and reminded me a lot about that those two narratives that I was caught between when I was a kid.
You created a cipher. We didn't talk much about that, but maybe you can explain the cipher and to some extent how it played a role in this story.
Yeah, I mean, the cipher in hip-hop is kind of the building block of the most organic form of hip-hop, right, where it starts. Is a cipher is a circle or a group of people that are beatboxing, which is vocal percussion, that are rapping, might be telling a story or poem. Somebody might sing or hum a melody, and all the voices kind of amalgamate into the layers of this collective performance. And I can remember, you know, kids beatboxing or beating on the lunch mm-hmm. table, and that's kind of where it started. And there's a lot of ciphers in this area, the NC State cipher that has a lot of local hip hop artists that started that at UNC. And so cipher's always been something that's really close to my heart, a space that where we can kind of share a piece of ourselves. And so in that moment in Alaska, we ended up having an unexpected cipher with some folks from very different backgrounds, very different stories. But in that moment, we were able to kind of transcend some of the lines between us.
Did it give you hope for this art and our future?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think we're in a rough time. You know, I think it's always been a rough time, but things are obviously out in the open in a way that makes them very intense. And I think the show has waves. You know, the show has moments of despair and loss of hope and deep introspection, and it has moments like these that are definitely like the jewels that keep us, trying to be optimistic.
Great stuff, Kane. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Great to see you
again.
Thank
you for having me.
Kane Smigo, writer and performer, hip-hop artist, created a new one-man show, Temples of Lung and Air, on stage at the Elizabeth Price Keenan Theater at UNC Chapel Hill next Wednesday, August 22nd through Sunday the 26th, directed by Joseph Meagle, presented by Playmakers and Street Signs. And all that information is at our website, stateofthings.org. Our upcoming movies on the radio. What cinematic universe do you most want to live in? Cyberpunk universe? You want to go to Hogwarts? You want to be in The Matrix? Give us your pick at sot@wnc.org or #SOTMovie. And you could be on Movies on the Radio on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.